Okay, looks like you're ready to go.
Thanks very much, Vern. It's a pleasure to be here. Most of my talk is still a work in progress. As Vern said, my day job is with the University of Minnesota. My other job is co-directing a large initiative for the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation called Harvest Choice. And the challenge we were given for that undertaking was to try and pull together cross-disciplinary teams of GIS specialists, crop modellers, pest and disease modellers and economists, and try and develop information and data that helps that foundation but also others target their investments into agricultural research to have the biggest impact that they can. And there's been quite a few speakers have remarked on the state of affairs with respect to agricultural R&D investments, and I'm going to give you some new numbers that we haven't published yet, but they're tagged as beta numbers, but I think my basic message isn't going to change as we finalise up these data. But just to give you a sense of, and to put this in a food security context, what I took here was data on basic commodity prices for the US back to 1924, and I indexed those so that all of those prices had a value of 100 in 1924 and tracked them out in real terms, so after we've taken account of general inflationary pressures, to look at the basic trends in commodity prices over the long haul. And most people gravitate to the price spikes that we see, and there's lots of attention to the price spikes that kicked off in 2007. And what these data do is put those spikes in a longer run perspective. And what they show that is even at the height of these spikes, consequential as they were for food insecure and poor people who are spending 70 to 80% of their income on food consumption, and so any increase in commodity prices has a substantial impact on their well-being. It turns out at the height of those, that the most recent spikes was well below, in real terms, the heights of the spikes that we saw in the early 1970s, and back in the mid-1930s, early 1940s. All of these spikes involved a nearly doubling in real terms of basic commodity prices. But what I'm going to fixate on today is not the price spikes, but in fact the interspike trends. And the big question on the table, it seems to me, going forward is that is this current price spike masking a much more fundamental structural shift in long-run commodity prices? So are we going to return to the sorts of trends that we saw between the previous spikes, which was a long-run decline in real commodity prices, or are we going to see commodity prices stabilise or, in fact, increase? I'll give you some data that I'm putting together, some emerging data that gives me at least a view on that, an informed view on that perspective. And the key trade-off here is that we have some views, and economists sort of have a reasonable consensus about what's going to happen with respect to per capita incomes over the next 30 or 40 years and population growth, and so that gives us a bit reasonable handle on the demand side. The big uncertainty is on the supply side, and all of the uncertainty hinges around productivity growth. So are we going to achieve the sorts of productivity performance in the next 30 or 40 years that some of our industry reps here would like to achieve, or that we would need to achieve to at least stabilise commodity prices or not. Most people's measured view of crop yields globally, and most of my data that I'm going to talk about is from a national perspective, started around 1961, because that's when the FAO data start. And as will be evident from my talk, I think to get a real handle on the relationships between R&D spending and productivity growth, we actually have to think about much longer time horizons, and hopefully that'll become evident from my remarks today. So I've been working for some time to push basic data back globally on crop areas, production, yield and analogous sorts of data back for about a century or so. And so here we have a pattern of this is average global crop yields from 1920 through to 2009. And we can see that for the 20s to the 60s, for 40 years, with fairly abysmal rates of yield growth. Most of those rates of growth are, all of them that I've measured are below 1%, and many of them are below 0.5% per annum. And then as we're all familiar, in the 60 period or so, and this is globally, not just the US, we saw this global uptick in the rates of yield growth, many of them 2% or more per annum. And towards the late 80s, early 1990s, we've seen this slowing down of that rate of growth. And they're all in red because they indicate globally there's a statistical slowdown in the rates of growth and sometimes substantial reductions of 1 to 1% to 0.5% per year in growth rates over the last couple of decades in this basic indicator. One of the other things which we haven't actually got to the bottom of yet, but is I'll throw it up because maybe some of the audience has some bright ideas, is that there's been a structural change in the spread or distribution of yields globally. So what I've done is I've taken a snapshot of the yield distribution, average yield distribution across countries for these three crops, and given you the distribution across countries for the first 20 years of the 20th century and for the last 20 years in our data. And what you can see is this levelling out or flattening of this yield distribution and a substantial increase in the cross-country variation in yield performance. So there's lots of things we have hunches about driving that, but it's opened up some lines of possibility, because if we're worried about global performance in crop production, there's major questions here. Is do we try and get the laggards moved up to more to the median yield levels or higher, so that we actually move the average across for all countries, or do we specialise and target our investments in the currently mid or high-end performers? Where is the biggest bang for the buck going to be? And as previous speakers have indicated, given the site specificity of lots of agricultural production practices and technologies, this is a fundamental question, I think, that needs to be addressed. In our project for the Gates Foundation, we've actually been spending a lot of money developing these maps and analogous sorts of data. So trying to answer a simple question of where in the world is corn, wheat, maize and cassava and so forth growing. And it turns out, as best we could assess, that there were no plausible spatially calibrated maps that are georeferenced to address this question. And so we've spent a lot of effort trying to put these data together. And what we've come up with is what we argue is a plausible spatial distribution of these commodities. And just circling the US there shows you that the physical footprint of those commodities is quite different. And that then calls forth a demand for evidence that's calibrated at this geospatial level. So we have these data. All of our analyses are done on a geospatial framework on a 10 by 10 kilometre grid. We focus most of our analytical work on sub-Saharan Africa, because that's where the Gates Foundation are focusing most of their efforts, and parts of South Asia. But substantial shares of our data layers are global in space. And what I just did here was to, again, this snapshot. This is a 2000 data, and we're well along to getting a 2005 set of data up and ready for release. Is to look at this huge distribution in terms of across pixels now, not countries, in terms of yield performance. So I've just arrayed these from the light to the darker colour and divvied up these pixels in terms of their deciles of yield performance in 2000. And just snapping out of that the pixels of the world, say for maize, that the share of the three highest deciles, so the highest yielding maize pixels, where in the world do they fall? It turns out that the US has about a third of the entire world's highest yielding maize pixels. Sub-Saharan Africa has 2.5%, and a country of origin for me is way down the track with 1.6%. And if you go across the board, similar sorts of patterns, but obviously a variation for rice, and a substantial share of the high yielding pixels in rice obviously are not in the US. And so, again, having broad-based sorts of analyses isn't sufficient to really target your interventions. You have to get at these very localised aspects that are driving productivity performance. Confounding this is something my group at Minnesota have been spending a lot of time on, is looking at the spatial dynamics of crop production. So we look out there and we see the physical footprint. So we have a 2000 snapshot of where in the world agriculture is, but that obviously is not where in the world agriculture was over the course of modern history even. And so we've done a lot of data grubbing in US data at the county level to come back and get calibrated and consistent data sets looking at production performance and patterns of major crops in the US dating back to the late 1800s. And you can see here that whilst we're looking at tracking sort of average yield performance, say for corn in the US, our denominator is its output divided by area, but that area is a different area in 1880 than it is in 2007. And that area comes with all sorts of soil and climate and other attributes. And so to get a strategic handle on the changing in that average yield performance, we have to get a plausible measured handle on the underlying changes in the natural inputs that go into agriculture, in addition to the ones we've been talking about here in terms of technologies and so forth. So where in the world crops are grown changes and, in fact, is endogenous to the technology. So the sorts of technologies that we introduced in the 30s gave rise, from the analysis we're doing, to substantial shifts in the location of production. And so if we're looking ahead and thinking about the impacts of climate change, I mean, I look at lots of models, many of them done by economists, about the impacts of climate change, and I think I'd throw them all out. Because they're basically taking the current footprints of agriculture and simulating out, holding that footprint constant. And I don't believe farmers are that stupid and that they're going to do the same things year in and year out, which includes time of planting, crop choice and things of that nature. So unless we get some measured handle on this aspect, I think most of these sort of simulations in terms of impacts of climate change and other factors on global food production are wanting. So big question is, do we actually have a productivity slowdown? If we look at these global data that we're putting together on crop yields, it's pretty evident when you look at sort of the 60s to 90s and then the post-90 period. If you look across this table, most of them, with the outlier being maize, where we've had a very substantial private sector presence, number one. And number two, the spatial location production of maize is highly concentrated. So it turns out the US, as you probably know, produces about 38 to 40% of the entire world's maize crop. And within a few hundred miles of where I sit on a day-to-day basis, about 40% of that entire production. So the spatial heterogeneity, the systems that are being targeted for those technologies are much more homogeneous for maize than they are for many other crops around the world. I personally think that's a very significant factor that gives rise to perhaps some of the variation we see at a point in time and the variation over time in yield performance. So it turns out, if you look at the number of countries that had yield performance slower post-1990 than pre-1990, it's a very substantial number. And so in most of these cases, it's more than half, and in often cases, it's two-thirds of the countries in this data set are revealing slower yield performance post-90 than pre-90. Yield is one measure of productivity. Economists concoct all sorts of other measures, and here's one that I've been developing for no less than 25 years. And this is a very comprehensive measure of total agricultural output over total measured inputs. So yield might go up just simply because we're using more fertiliser or more irrigation and things of that nature. And what we try to do in these measures is get a measure of fertiliser and energy and weedicides and pesticides and so forth, and get a much more comprehensive measure of all of the sort of measured inputs going into agriculture, and comparing that with the rate of change in aggregate output growth. The really worrying thing for me is these data, and as we keep updating them, we've just updated them to 2007, they're benchmarked around census data, is a dramatic slowing down in the rates of multi-factor productivity growth in US agriculture, nearly a halving. So it's not yields, this is all output over all measured inputs is now growing at just barely 1.2%, where it used to grow over 2% per annum. 44 of the 48 contiguous states in the US have significant slowdowns post-90 in multi-factor productivity growth. So this is no longer a blip. This started to come into my focus a few years ago. It's very hard to discern trend shifts from blips, but I'm pretty convinced that we've got a structural shift going on here, and this is worrisome. It's worrisome because how do we turn that around? And one of the big ways of turning that around, lots of economic evidence, some of which I've contributed to, as Vern mentioned, about the sort of rates of returns to R&D. And what is the relationship between R&D spending and productivity growth? I think most people in this room would have an understanding of the complexities of that. Most policymakers I talk to think you can turn this thing around on a dime, and that's just not how it works. We worked with some colleagues at Monsanto and did some of our own work just to track out these technology timelines. And what I did was, in these, is to try and track all of the significant technological nodes that occurred in the development of just three emblematic technologies, hybrid corn, BT corn, and Roundup Ready soybean. So when do people in the know think that there were very substantial jumps? And there's I won't have time to go into here, but there's all differences between the public and private roles, and it's a very complex role, and it's not a standard linear. The public does some work and hands it off to the private sector. It's much more complicated than that. But the point of the slide here is to say, from the initial discoveries to the points of first commercialisation, these are the lag lengths in each one of those prime technologies, whether it involves public and private research or whatever. So these are decades from the point of initial development to commercialisation. And once you commercialise it, that's just the beginning of the story. Here's some data on looking, it's an amalgam of area in agriculture, the share of the area in agriculture, for example, or that's in semi-dwarf wheat, soybeans, corn and so forth, and the proportion of farms, for example, to using tractors and telephone and hybrid electricity. So this is the US where we think everything works. This is not the sort of countries I spend most of my time working on. And it turns out that to get 80% market penetration for hybrid corn took 18 years from the date of first commercialisation to 80% of the area in hybrid corn was 18 years. For BT corn, it was 13 years. So it still wasn't a year or two. It was a decade and a half. That's on top of the lags I had in the previous slide. So we've done lots of hairy and gory econometrics to work out, on average, for the US, what's the lag relationship between when I spend a buck and when it exacerbates its productivity impact. It turns out, as economists, we've been grossly underestimating that lag structure. So I put together data that goes back to 1880 through to now, and we have these long-run productivity measures. It turns out that average yield is 50 years. So you get some returns later, some returns longer, but on average it takes 50 years from when you invest a dollar to when you exacerbate its productivity impact. That's in the US where we think everything works. The sort of countries I work, it could be substantially longer than that. So what do we know about what we're investing in R&D? Here is some hot off the press data, even though they're 2005, it's a soul destroying job, you can never get it as contemporary as people would like. But this is my view, a slice of the world of where in the world is public sector ag R&D being performed and how much. So our estimate is that we're putting just under $29 billion, US dollar, PPP dollars, into agriculture R&D. The US makes up just under 16% of that global slice. The rich countries, the high-income countries in total, make up just over half of that total slice. So nearly half of that research is being performed in low and middle-income countries and about half in the public sector research in high-income countries. I draw your attention to India and China combined are now spending more on public ag R&D than the US. And in my data, which we're tracking over about a quarter of a century, those folks have come from way behind to now significant players. So I would watch that space going forward. The place in the world I spend a lot of time in, sub-Saharan Africa, which is in woeful need of investments in ag R&D, is really hurting and finding it very hard to sort of move in many directions that are useful. If you aggregate all of this up and look at regional trends over time, this is actually quite revealing. So as you'd expect, the high-income countries are spending the biggest share of this pie and have been since the 1960s. But over this nearly half a century of data, you can see some slow changes, but non-trivial changes in the location of performance of public ag R&D globally. So those gaps there are the gaps between the Asia-Pacific countries as a group and the high-income countries back in 1960. So the high-income countries were spending about 4.5 times more than the Asia-Pacific group, and they were spending about 6 times more than sub-Saharan Africa. The Asia-Pacific countries are closing that gap, that spending gap. They're now at they're only 2.3-fold less than the rich countries, and the gap is widening between investments in ag R&D in sub-Saharan Africa and the high-income countries. Lots of people have been talking about reductions in spending. And that may well be true in agronomy and specific areas, but in aggregate, it's not generally a story of reduction, but it is a story of a slowdown in the rate of growth, which is a different idea, but notable nonetheless. And so you see here, the growth in expenditures on the left-hand side divvied up between low and middle-income countries and notably high-income countries on the right of that left-hand side. So essentially in the rich countries during the last decade, real R&D spending in aggregate has stalled, is what that's saying. Whereas back in the 60s, it was growing at a real rate of growth of over 4% per annum. And there's constant ratcheting down in the rates of growth. Not a negative rate of growth, but a ratcheting down and a positive rate of growth. Sub-Saharan Africa, you can see perhaps a rebound there in the 2000s, but that's off a totally abysmal level of investment in the 1990s, so they're rebounding off a very low level, and it's very patchy. Nigeria is recovering, and they got oil money coming in and some quasi-more respectable policies in place, and they're a big player in Africa, but the general story in Africa is not a pretty one. Looking at the OECD countries, I've been putting together some brand new data on public and private ag R&D spending. So one of the things I hear all the time is, it doesn't matter from policymakers, it doesn't matter that the public sector's ratcheting back because the private sector's stepping in to fill that gap. That's true, but only up to a point, and I'll put a real big footnote on that point with a slide in a slide or two. So you can see, in fact, the private sector slowed down in tandem with the public sector in the last couple of decades. There's a slight rebound in the 2000 period, but compare the 1990 to the 1980 period, where we had this massive agglomeration of life science companies going on in the mid to late 80s and early 90s, and then a major divestiture of that in the 1990s, where they weren't able to cash in on the sort of cash flows that were expected from those industrial mergers. And so it's a patchy story with respect to private sector spending. Looking at the US in particular, it's the same hobby horse, but with an additional caveat that hasn't been mentioned here, which really worries me. That is a very substantial ratcheting down in the growth of public spending. That's what the left-hand side growth is. So it's now growing in the last 2 decades at less than 1% per annum in the US. It grew at 3.6% per annum back in the 50s and 60s. The other thing is, what we call research now in the land grants and the USDAs is not what research was 30 or 40 years ago. So we went through all of the CRIS data files, project by project by project, and tagged them. And I tagged them, this is my view, of all of those projects that had anything to do with enhancing or maintaining farm productivity. That's what the right-hand side graph is there. A massive reorientation in the structure of that R&D. And so now barely 56%, just over half of all the research that goes on in the public sector in the US has got anything to do with farm productivity. Lots of pressures on the experiment stations to do all sorts of other things, worrying about the environmental footprint of agriculture, food security, biosafety, obesity, nutrition, all of those things. All of those public monies have sort of political strings attached to them, and it turns out the USDA share of total funding in the experiment stations has shrunk fairly dramatically, and lots of the money from the federal agencies is now coming from the EPA and NIH and NSF, and they all have various constituencies and orientations to that research, so it's dramatically shifting the research portfolio of the land grants. So you can't just look at the totals, you have to look at what's actually going on. Notably, if you remember the first slide, there was a upward spike in prices back in the early 1970s, and politicians started to run scared that we were running out of food. The sad story is that, and so you can see, we actually started shifting more research back into enhancing farm productivity, but it only lasted for 3 or 4 years. So take note, I suspect that same, if the politics hasn't changed, which I don't think it has, I think unfortunately, lots of people are thinking that we've now got a new era of concern about food security and so forth, remains to be seen. Just a couple of slides and I'll finish up. The private sector, you've got to worry about what that is too. So we've had folks here from Pioneer and Dow, and many people think that's what the private sector is. Turns out that's not the private sector with respect to food and ag R&D. Over 60% of that research has got nothing to do with farm production. It's got everything to do with post-farm food processing. Just think about it for a minute, where the value chains are in agriculture, they've moved dramatically post-farm. And so a large share of that, what we tag as private food and ag R&D, as I say, has got nothing to do with farm productivity. It's been a pretty stable 62%. This is for all of the high-income countries, a gradual inching up, I'd say not a wholesale movement over into privately performed food and ag R&D. So just on half of the ag R&D now in food and ag R&D is done by the private sector, which is still substantially less than the overall share of private research in all science. So it's about 78% in the US of the research is private, but it's particular sorts of private research. And large differences, as you can see on the right-hand side there, across countries in both their food share as a share of total food and ag, or food processing share, and the private share as a share of ag. Looking at spending levels is one thing. Looking at how intensively you invest in research is another. So what's the level of spending relative to the size of the ag sector? So you'd expect a country with a big value of production like the US to spend substantially more than a country like Australia, which is pretty small. And so how intensively, what's the ratio of R&D spending relative to ag R&D output? Just in the fullness of time, just focus on the public and private panel on the right there. It shows this yawning and widening gap between the intensity of investments in ag R&D between the low and middle income countries and the high income countries. So on average, in the high income countries, you put about $5.40 into ag R&D for every $100 of output. In the low-income countries, 50 cents, 50 to 60 cents. And so the amount of sort of knowledge deepening and technology deepening that's going on is indicated a bit by these, and so pause for thought and concern. So in closing, I think there's really compelling evidence, unfortunately, of a slowdown in productivity growth. It's not in one country or one crop or whatever, and there's exceptions to this. The big exception is China. It's been able to sustain a rate of productivity growth, which is to be envied, and not surprisingly, it's sustained a very high rate of increase in ag R&D spending. This productivity slowdown is most evident in the high-income countries, but it's also fairly widespread in the rest of the world. There's evidence mounting that this relationship between R&D spending and the forms of R&D spending and productivity growth is has a big part of the message here. But as I say, it's a very long-run relationship. So if we're talking about global food security of 2040, 2050, the sorts of decisions we're taking right now is going to affect that outcome 30 or 40 years later. These technology processes take a long time to reveal their hand up. My final slide is, here's what's happened in the world with respect to per capita. So I've taken the aggregate value of production of agriculture for all of the countries in the world for the last century, put it in constant dollar terms, and looked at how much do we produce in aggregate relative to the size of the population. And you can see this fairly steady growth, but with some World War I and World War II, food production dropped off very substantially during that period. So in aggregate, my estimates are that we're producing about $134 per capita in 1990, and we're producing about $241 per capita in 2000. Looking forward, I took the US productivity growth rates and said, what if the world looked like the US going forward, and had three scenarios. One scenario was a high rate of growth, that is the average from the end of the Second World War through to 2007, that 1.78% rate of growth, and that would get us up to about $400 per capita by 2050. If we took the 1990 to 2007 rate of growth, which is substantially lower, that would get us up to about $316 per capita. But we projected forward in the US based on our econometric models and said if we did nothing different, if the rate and orientation of R&D spending stayed the same more or less now going forward, the world's output per capita would barely budge, notwithstanding the substantial and slowing rate of growth in population worldwide. I hope we have the green run, not the red one, going forward. But the bottom line is it's actually a policy choice. There's nothing set in stone in these projections. It's a policy choice as to where we end up. So I'll finish there. Thanks a lot.